Greetings to everyone, and thanks so much for joining us. We're standing here on the corner of Wall Street and Main Street. We'll be speaking with some of the top minds and biggest names from both worlds. I'm your host, Douglas Blake, and this is the Wall and Main Podcast. Greetings and welcome to the Wall and Main Podcast. We're joined today by none other than Senior Managing Director of Virtus Investment Partners, CNBC contributor, and St. John's University's own Joe Terranova. Joe, welcome to the Wall and Main Podcast.
Doug, thank you so much for having me, and a wonderful introduction. I appreciate that.
I'm a Queens native, if you couldn't tell.
Well, things are back at St. John's and Queens once again with Rick Pitino in town.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm excited, you know, with the Knicks in contention, the Jets and St. John's, I'm pinching myself. I don't know what happened here, but, you know, they say, what is it? Lucky in love, unlucky in money. I think lucky in sports, I haven't really had before. So I don't know where the bad luck's going to come, but, you know, I'm definitely excited for the next couple of years.
I grew up an Islander fan, so I got lucky with the 4 Stanley Cups in the 80s.
That's right. But, you know, it's been a while.
It is.
It's been a long time since the 80s. So I think a lot of the recognition that you get comes from your presence in the financial media. You've been a fixture on CNBC for many years. Yes. What's it like being that kind of famous? What's it like being recognized? And what kind of interactions do you have with your fans?
It's an unbelievable privilege. Incredibly humbling. I grew up in Valley Stream, Long Island. We had a very modest upbringing. I went to Chaminade High School on Long Island. And I really view myself as just another example of the possibility that exists in this wonderful American mosaic. You know, I watched the Arnold documentary on Netflix the other day, and he said something interesting. He said he's not a self-made man. And I couldn't agree with that more. There are so many people that helped me along the way, whether it was initially my mom helped me so much, educators along the way. But then there were mentors on Wall Street that helped me. And where I am now and the ability to walk down a street in Manhattan and have a viewer stop you and thank you for what you do on CNBC and, you know, discuss your views on what you're seeing in the market. And of course, ask you what Scott Wapner and Josh Brown and Stephen Weiss are like and Stephanie Link. It is so remarkably humbling. It's a privilege. And every day that I sit in that chair, Doug, I feel like I'm playing in the Super Bowl. Every time you sit in that chair, you feel as though you're playing in the Super Bowl and I'm living a dream.
Yeah, I have to say, I spent a little bit of time at the NASDAQ as a correspondent for another news network. And when I was on, I was in one of the booths upstairs. This was years ago. And Fast Money was on the main stage downstairs. And I would look down and see the group there having so much fun. But I could also see how exciting every day was. You know, it is kind of a mix of business and really a lot of fun. And I looked, you know, like through the glass, envious of what that must have felt like for you. And I have to sort of backtrack here a little bit. I'm a Long Island guy myself. We had Josh Brown on the podcast. He was incredible. Also a Long Island guy. Long Island is an interesting place, right? You're close to the city, but you have all these little towns in very close proximity to each other and these very strong communities. What contribution do you think that had to forming who you are and sending you on your way into your career?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is rooted in the nature of where we're living, where you understand, because you're in close proximity to so many different towns, so you have the ability to not kind of insulate yourself and be somewhat cliquey within your town, but to become friends and develop relationships with people throughout Nassau County, which is where I reside. It's also, you know, a very hardworking environment. And I think that's one of the things that I learned early, the lessons of working hard. And most successful people that I meet, they'll share two things with you. They'll say that they have very strong discipline and that it's very difficult for someone else to ultimately try and outwork them. And I think those are lessons that were ingrained in me at a very young age. I think that's what's special about Long Island, certainly Nassau County. And Doug, I'll tell you a remarkable story. Look, I've been at CNBC now 15 years. I've also been with Virtus Investment Partners, which is an asset management firm listed on the NASDAQ from headquarters in Hartford, Connecticut. I've been there 15 years as well. Here's an absolutely remarkable story. I graduated Chaminade High School. Our CEO graduated St. John the Baptist, which is a rival to Chaminade. Right. One of my direct reports at Virtus Investment Partners, I grew up in Valley Stream, and he resided in Rockville Center. But this is the most remarkable story of it all. Our CFO was the second baseman on my Little League team. I was the first baseman. He was the second baseman. I got a phone call when our CFO joined the company, and they said, "Hey, do you know Michael Angerthal? Mike's the CFO." I said, "Of course I know Michael Angerthal. He was the second baseman on my VFW Little League baseball team." They said, "Well, they're joining Virtus Investment Partners." So, unique story. Our CEO, George Aylward from St. John the Baptist, Barry Mandanak from Rockville Center, tight-knit community, and we have the distinct pleasure of all working together now.
It's a great story. And there's many of those on Long Island. And, you know, I have my origin story. I'm from the South Shore. I'm from Amityville, okay. Which is, I know you're proud of your Nassau County brethren. I'm right on the border. I literally grew up on County Line Road. So, you know, I was in Suffolk County, but if I wanted to catch the ice cream man, I had to go across county into Nassau. But I agree. And I think there's a weird kind of, it's almost like a territorial pride on Long Island. You'd have your rivalry with the adjacent town. And my nephews, I'm seeing it now, and they're competitive in sports and they're competitive in school. And, you know, it's based on the way that Long Island is structured. They each have 35 best friends. I've never seen anything like it before. You know, their whole class kind of grows up together and goes through these phases together. I moved up to Westchester. I have two daughters and, you know, they each have a couple of friends here and there. But there's really nothing like Long Island and sort of this this movement. You know, your vintage, your age group stays together. And I'm still close with, you know, dozens of people from my elementary school and high school. Maybe it's something in the water, right? As we might say.
Yes.
So interestingly enough, 15 years ago, you started out both Virtus and CNBC. And if I, you know, use my cocktail napkin math, 15 years ago is also when the global financial crisis really started. Now it was an event that pushed financial media into the mainstream. What impact, good or bad, do you think that had on investors?
Oh, I think it had a remarkably strong impact in motivating investors for the very first time to embrace financial literacy in a way that, candidly, Doug, you and I did not at a younger age. It also created a movement in academia to begin to teach financial literacy. And I'm a big believer how important that is. So I will share that I suspect that financial literacy is being dispensed to a much younger generation than in prior decades. In prior decades, you learned about investing and markets once you became relatively successful in your profession. Now, through the efforts and really the results of the great financial crisis, you will see that whether it's middle school or high school, and I've participated in that education process, there is a distinct effort to educate a younger generation about financial literacy and the very need for it. And I think that's ultimately going to create strong demand for investable assets themselves. Now, everyone has a learning curve, and we've seen in the last couple of years that there are mistakes that are being made in the investment world, but that's okay. We've all made mistakes. And as long as we stay consistent in participating, as long as we understand that discipline is what matters most, and we are learning from our mistakes, I believe that what we are creating is a much more financially educated younger generation. And I think that benefits the economy and society as a whole in the long run.
Completely agree. And that's, you know, the financial literacy and the resources and information available to this generation of investors is unlike anything we've ever seen before. And the democratization, I think, of that information has been a really significant change in the way that investors participate in this industry. But, you know, that was the easy question. Here's the hard question. What about social media? And what about the impact that social media has had on investing? And maybe even just as a little flashpoint, that whole fiasco with Robinhood and Citadel a few years ago.
Yeah, I think we're still trying to, I don't know that we're ever going to perfect it, but we're still, I believe, trying to root out the negative effects if possible. I think we're trying to, again, in an educational capacity, understand how social media can be valuable, and it can be valuable. But I also think that there's not enough guardrails in place. There's not enough right now within social media that allows for a single voice to be attached to a single identity. We really need to focus on having the guardrails and having a cohesive systemic approach to where we can have an individual only have one voice on social media. Because I think what's happening, unfortunately, is that there is an individual who may have a particular ideology, agenda, or in financial markets, a bias, and they're able to take advantage of social media in then allowing for that single identity to form itself in multiple voices through what we obviously know to be fake accounts. And I think that's part of the challenge inherently that has to be over the next, you know, coming years, figured out.
Right. And you know, to take a step further, the crypto, you know, fiasco and FTX and all of these other controversies that, you know, emerged because investors were, you know, led to believe that an investment in this type of entity was just as safe and just as transparent as the typical investments that they were used to before the rise of this new media, this new sales pitch of financial assets through unvetted resources. I just think that investors assumed, because they had been taken care of to that point, that they would enjoy the same safeguards with investments that were permitted to market themselves through the mainstream. And it turned out they weren't.
Right. But what's troubling, Doug, is, you know, when we think about being led in a particular direction, we don't even know that we can confirm the single identity of who's leading us in that direction on social media. We believe we might know. And in addition to that, you know, there are registrations that all of us in the financial services industry are required to partake in. We're being led on social media in certain instances by identities that we don't even know if those registration qualifications exist or not.
Right. And you know, I think the good news here is while the wild, wild west had its rise and its subsequent fall of social media investing, let's call it, and hopefully you and I will be a part of the 2.0 version of that, because the concept is very promising, and it's certainly the way to get in front of the next generation of investors. It's not ready for prime time just yet. Wealth management has undergone a significant transformation, really from active to passive. I think this is where the work has been done. And trillions of dollars now flow through exchange-traded funds, institutional management, turnkey asset management platforms on a daily basis. Do you see that sort of automation of the financial services industry in a broader sense as a good thing or a bad thing?
I think a lot of it was rooted in the monetary policy since the great financial crisis, which ultimately has now had this paradigm shift, beginning with Chairman Powell's communication in November of 2021 about the need to begin to normalize interest rates and to begin to take the abundant historic levels, trillions of dollars, nearly $9 trillion of liquidity out of the system. So the passive investing movement of the last 5 to 7 years, I suspect, benefited from the substantial increase in liquidity. And ultimately, I think the jury is going to remain out on the sidelines if, in fact, passive investing can be as beneficial as it was in the last 5 to 7 years, in the absence not only of an injection of liquidity, but 180 degrees different, the removal of that liquidity itself. So we'll see on the other side whether passive investing was able to maintain the beneficial effect of the last 5 to 7 years. I'm not so sure that it can, in particular in nuanced areas of investing in select asset classes like fixed income.
Right. And this kind of gave birth to, or gave rise to, popularity of a couple of different strategies that I think are going to address that. I want standardization of my investment strategy, but I also want the ability to customize my investments. If I'm an advisor and I want to set my clients on a certain path where I'm sort of, you know, making an educated guess or a call on market direction, or if I'm an individual investor and I want to maybe cut out a couple of areas of the market that I don't like for whatever reason, or emphasize a few where I think there's opportunity. It was hard to do that in a passive investment strategy until now, but exchange-traded funds are one of the biggest disruptors in finance, led by the likes of Vanguard, BlackRock, and of course, Virtus Investment Partners. And at the end of 2022, there was an estimated $6.7 trillion in ETFs between the US and Europe, growing three times faster than mutual funds since 2010. Could you explain the rise in popularity of ETFs, and what are some of the favorable attributes that contributed to that?
Well, there's the obvious tax advantage. There's the transparency of ETFs. There's the liquidity. There's the ease of transaction. It's obviously the next step. It's obviously an improvement in the financial services products that we're delivering to investors themselves. And I think in particular for equities, to your point on customization, it really provides an opportunity for a more broad selection process in terms of the supply of investable assets that could be utilized in a portfolio than previously existed in an environment where we did not see this tremendous growth of ETFs. And I think as we move forward, you will continue to see more and more in the growth of ETFs. I would expect there would be a little bit more of a pivot in that growth to where we're beginning to create models in a portfolio. So you'll have these models that'll have multiple asset classes combined into one single product that will offer a solution, a single solution for a portfolio itself.
Right. And direct indexing is something that I'm hearing a lot more about these days. So we'll kind of, you know, keep our ear to the tracks for the rise of that concept. And it's true. I think now that we've been educated on the right way to allocate money through our, you know, passive investment strategies, we're starting to say, yes, that makes sense. And that's, you know, the most efficient and effective way to put our money to work. But I want to vote in where that money goes. And I think that's where ETFs and eventually something like direct indexing is going to come to play. Speaking of ETFs, I'm speaking to an ETF right now, Joe Terranova. JOET is the ticker symbol for the Virtus Terranova U.S. Quality Momentum ETF. What is it like having an ETF named after you? And how did you decide on the strategy that you wanted to put your name on?
It's, first of all, it's satisfying. I'll tell you why. Because finally, the views that I'm sharing on CNBC can actually stand against a win and lost record, so to speak. It's not just the listeners hearing what I think about markets and hearing stocks that I believe an investor might be inclined to buy on a cyclical or a secular basis. But now it's, how do I think about markets? It's wrapped into a strategy, and the performance is there for investors to observe. Now, in terms of performance, it's interesting because I am on CNBC. So Doug, here's my benchmark. My benchmark is the NASDAQ. It's the Russell. It's the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it's the S&P, and then, it's what it really is, which are the two factors and the reasoning behind why I introduced the strategy, and that's a factor of quality and a factor of momentum. So those are the true benchmarks in terms of what is it exactly we intended to improve upon by introducing the product. So for many years, I sit at CNBC and we'd have analysts come on and we'd have hedge fund managers and portfolio managers come on and they'd sit with us and they'd talk about a particular stock. And they would eloquently express all the fundamental reasoning as to why this stock should be owned. And then ultimately, towards the end of their overwhelmingly optimistic narrative, they'd say, and if you look at the chart, the stock continues to move higher. And ultimately, what I realized is that because markets had become so quantitatively impacted, where rules-based, non-discretionary funds were beginning to overtake daily transactional volume, and really overall fund volume within markets, I realized how important momentum was, the study of momentum. And the study of momentum is nothing more than saying, where can I find technical confidence? Where can I find technical confidence represented in a particular equity? And I could find it by just observing the stock. Is it going from the lower left to the upper right? And I felt in that regard, that was exposing an investor who was allocating towards a single factor of momentum to excessive risk in an environment where markets began to correct. So the product was introduced, it was incepted in November of 2020. And quite candidly, what unfolded over the next year and a half has spoken to exactly my very concern: change in monetary policy, removal of liquidity, unprecedented rate hikes, and momentum literally imploded. So, can you improve upon momentum by now introducing a factor that observes where there's fundamental confidence, combining the strength of technicals with the strength of fundamentals and creating a proprietary criteria that looks very importantly at return on equity, debt to equity, and sales growth, average sales growth on a 36-month period, Can you combine those two factors and improve upon the single factor of momentum? And I'm very satisfied because I believe we have. It's large cap oriented. It scans a universe of 500 of the largest U.S. listed stocks. It narrows that 500 down to 250 initially with a momentum screen. And then it introduces the quality screen to further narrow the list down to 125 holdings that are equally weighted, and they rebalance and reconstitute on a quarterly basis. So we feel as though we are always speaking about the market personality of today. And that's what we're trying to capture. Doug, last point on all of this. I always say, if you speak to a growth manager, they tell you about the future. They speak with optimism towards the future. If you speak to a value manager, they reflect on the reliability of the past and why that reliability will return once again. This product attempts to speak towards today, and it's ever-changing. It takes the shape of what the market personality is, and we saw that reflected in the most recent quarterly rebalance at the end of April, where we saw a significant pivot back towards mega caps, back towards technology once again, began to reduce energy and materials. And that's exactly that, in fact, speaks to the market personality of today.
If I'm reminded of the psychological tenet that if you're anxious, you're living in the future. If you're depressed, you're living in the past. And if you're at peace, you're living in the present. Right. So this is a strategy that kind of speaks towards that, I guess. But I think this is such a cool concept that I want to deconstruct here a little bit, because it sounds like, you know, and I think there are a lot of people that have tried to do this, but maybe haven't had the platform, the partners, and the ability to give it a shot. What is the perfect balance of investing? You know, how do you accommodate for the anxiety or the fear of missing out that you feel when you see stocks moving higher and you want to jump in? How do you capitalize on the drawdowns in the market that are depressing you, but if you would just wake up and take advantage of them, you'd have a better outcome in the longer term? And how do you read the market at present to make sure that, you know, you're on the sunny side of the street in terms of what's working in the markets overall? And to reverse engineer that into this investment strategy, I think, is brilliant. And, you know, this reminds me, if you go all the way back to Jesse Livermore, if we talk about momentum and his reminiscences of a stock operator, the notion that he could look at the boards and know what stock was going up based on how it was trading. And he didn't need to know what it was or what they did. He could tell you a good bet from a bad bet just based on the market activity. Then you go to Investor's Business Daily, you go to Bill O'Neill, and the idea of it's the chart is going to tell you everything you need to know. And then if you go back and look at the fundamentals, you'll find that they support this momentum that you're seeing in the stock price. You do see, you know, the canned slim, as we would say, attributes, and that's an acronym that talks about certain attributes of a stock that tends to perform well. And seeing it, you can kind of do the post-mortem and say, this stock is successful because these things happened. And the idea with Bill O'Neill was to try to find the stocks that were in that position before the big breakout. And so I think what you've done here is you've tried to real time, you know, all of the different schools of thought of successful investing into an exchange traded fund, if I'm not mistaken. I don't want to kind of speak on your behalf.
No, and that's eloquently stated. You know, again, going back since inception, if you study a single factor of momentum since November of 2020, which is remarkable, think about November of 2020. That's the introduction of three vaccines. Okay, that's the reopening began to take hold. and you're staring at a single factor of momentum that's negative, while the S&P 500 is up well over 25% in that environment. So without question, we've improved upon the single factor of momentum. And this is a core equity holding. That's how this should be viewed. There are going to be periods in which it will underperform. If you're looking at the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, there's going to be periods it's going to underperform. There are periods it's going to outperform. But it's also going to, in a very nuanced way, capture the story of the market today. And it's going to keep you anchored towards where there's confidence in the market, both technically and fundamentally. What's important is the quality factor. I look at quality much different than the traditional sense of quality, because the market is still overwhelmingly growth. I think you would agree with that, Doug. Absolutely. And you want to still have a strong representation of where is their growth, right? Where is their growth in the market, and not where is their growth over the last four quarters or even over the last eight quarters. But you really want to look on a little bit of a longer term basis. And I think 36 months is the right time frame, because that's a true reflection of the durability of the presence of growth for companies. So it's humbling. It's remarkable. I thank Virtus Investment Partners for giving me the opportunity to introduce this strategy. And Doug, quite candidly, the success of the strategy is something that we'll know long after I'm gone. My children will realize the success of it. And the success of it will be if eventually the product grows more and more in its usage in portfolios and delivers exactly what advisors are utilizing the portfolio of the product for within the portfolio. And we'll know the answer to that in the coming decades.
Stay tuned. I don't know if the Wall and Main podcast will be around to tally up the final score in a couple of decades, but I certainly hope so. You know, on CNBC, and I think the reason that it's great to have a durable product like this in the market that kind of follows your thought patterns and follows your strategy is when you're watching financial media, it's very hard to act on the information that you get. It's always tactical. If I'm a casual viewer and I see a recommendation, you know, as we know in wealth management, buying a stock is only half the story, right? Anyone can buy a stock. How do you own it? How long do you hold it? When do you sell it? Do you sell it? And do you sell it for a profit? And so unless you're willing to literally sit and watch 100% of the content, and not only that, but as long as the network is willing to continue to host these recommendations and the people behind them for as long as, you know, they get from the buy to the sell, then you could potentially use this as a resource. It's more, in my opinion, an informative educational tool for investing. I'm not going to follow the recommendations of the journalists and the contributors that are participating in this form of media, because it's an incomplete picture of exactly, is this right for me? Is this right for my clients? I know we can buy it today. When are we supposed to sell it? You know, so I think I've made my point, but because the recommendations that are done on financial media are tactical in nature and not specific to an investor and their needs, which is really kind of, you know, the mantra in wealth management, I was hoping for a simplified summary of your approach to investing. Joe Terranova's elevator pitch to successful investing.
So I think you have to have the ability to always change and always learn. Now I'm obviously dating myself and showing my age, but you know, I've been in this business for the better part of three decades. And I'm still learning. I'm still changing. A couple of things I think are important. First, simplicity. Simplicity works best. If there's something you don't understand, then you don't invest in it. And just because everyone else is investing in it, if you still don't understand it, that's more of a reason to stay away from it. Number two, if you don't have a risk management strategy and you don't have the discipline to follow the risk management strategy, then you're always going to be unsatisfied with the performance of your portfolio. And the last thing, which I think is really important, is that everyone has intuitive observations of the market. What's critical, in particular, as markets mature, as we introduce generative AI, as quantitative strategies begin to deepen their presence within markets, it's important to have a rules-based, non-emotional approach to investing. And Doug, that's exactly what I have introduced within the strategy. And I'll give you an example. Back in April, the strategy went back into, after sitting out for one quarter, mega caps, Microsoft, Apple, Meta, NVIDIA, Adobe. Very difficult decision if you're thinking about making the decision on emotion. Why? Because like everyone else, you had such a dramatic rise where, you know, like the rest of the bearish community, they're still looking for the pullback. People right now at the S&P at 4362 are still saying, when am I getting my 3,800 to get back into markets once again? So I think that rules-based approach is so incredibly important. Combine that with simplicity. Combine that with a strong risk management process. Combine that with discipline. And I think if you define a series of goals and outcome for what you want your portfolio as a vehicle to be in your life, I think ultimately you'll achieve those goals and outcomes relatively easily.
That's great advice. And the next question would be, because that's a philosophy I think that we could all get our head around. But investing, you know, if you've been doing this for three decades, Joe, you have been thrown all over the place by just about every, you know, crisis du jour, significant or otherwise, you know, that has reared its ugly head as we're just trying to get, you know, from accumulation to distribution. Our audience is right smack dab in the middle of what we might as well call the podcast demographic, right? 35 to 55 years old. What advice would you give our listeners to help them be successful over the long term?
And that's exactly what the target should be, being successful over the long term. I believe that we have had abnormal markets in the last 7 years. And I think we're normalizing the abnormality. I believe the pandemic was an emotional parabolic state that brought it all to a crescendo. And subsequent to that, we're beginning to get to what I think is a healthier market, a market in which Merck has the same significant value as, if not more, than a lot of the emerging software and semiconductor companies that have profitability at some point in the future. So I think you have to have an awareness to invest in places that in the last 5 to 7 years were unpopular. And I'll give you a great example. I think very few people realize this. Year to date, Japan is up 26.5%. And it's trading at a multi-decade high. Now, if you think about Japan, Japan isn't exactly an economy that mirrors the United States. Doesn't have its own source of domestic oil. It has to import its energy. It's certainly not an economy that benefits from the presence of national companies like we have here in the United States, Microsoft, Adobe, Texas Instruments, Alphabet, Apple. So I think you have to learn to look in places as an investor for opportunities that seem somewhat unique and different than the last 5 to 7 years. And what's the word that we ascribe to that exercise? It's diversification. And in the last 5 to 7 years, you really were able to concentrate and get paid for that. Now, if you're Warren Buffett, you're going to concentrate. And concentration worked and will work for someone like Warren Buffett because they have the financial firepower to concentrate. But for individual investors, unfortunately, they don't have that financial firepower. And thinking about the long term, I think diversification is going to be advantageous in your portfolio. And the last point is understand something. Not everything in your portfolio should work at every given moment. There are going to be assets within your portfolio that are there for a future moment in time. And think about inflation-friendly assets. How many people had inflation-friendly assets in their portfolio in 2018, 2019?
Right.
Or coming into 2020.
We were wondering if we'd ever even see inflation again at that time. I remember it. And doing everything we could to fight deflation.
And think of the value of having inflation-friendly assets in your portfolio in 2021 into 2022. So I just think that's an important reminder, in particular for a younger generation. Have an awareness, have an open mind to explore for opportunities in places that have been non-traditional and in a certain sense are more qualitative in their nature than you might be accustomed to allocating towards. Because in the last several years, non-profitability was treated in the same regard as profitability in this environment where the cost of capital is no longer free. I don't think that's going to work.
You know, I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I think there is so much here. This is such a wealth of information that our advisors, that our casual listeners can tap into, and the insight is incredibly valuable. There's a bunch of stuff we could get to regarding today's market and, you know, obviously the Fed meeting and 2022. You know, I'm actually going to scrap all that because we know where to find Joe Terranova, that's for sure. And you've done such a great job. And like the people stopping you on the street, I have to personally thank you for devoting so much time and effort to financial literacy, to getting on the financial media channels like a CNBC and giving perspective that's backed by some sort of science that can teach us how to interpret market activity, how to interpret monetary policy and Fed intervention, and how to act on that in a way that makes sense or that's backed by some sort of knowledge-based or scientific approach. It's so valuable day to day, week to week, year to year, when these markets are on a roller coaster, to have voices like yours kind of shepherding us through the volatility and the uncertainty. I want to kind of take us home on this one. We like to talk about a theme here on the podcast because Wall and Main, kind of like business pleasure, right? You've got your everyday heroes, you've got your captains of industry. We all blend together. And I like to say that if you call it a work-life balance, it's wrong because you're still putting work first. So we call it the life-work balance here. What is Joe Terranova's life-work balance, given the fact that you've got so much going on Wall Street?
So I stay in shape. It's very important. It's something that at a very young age, I learned to do. And that's a priority. In the last several years, I learned to play golf, not very well. Really didn't pick up a golf club until 2020. And it's not something that I grew up with. I knew others played golf, but my family couldn't afford to join golf courses. And it's not something I got involved in. So you know, those are two things that I do for myself. But I think most importantly, what I do for myself, I have three children, and it's just about, you know, them and investing in them and their future. And I have a son who just graduated Chaminade, and he's preparing for college, and it's giving him the tools that he needs to explore what his chosen profession will be. I have a middle son who's a competitive hockey player. He's still in high school. It's giving him the tools and training that are required to continue to compete in hockey. And the same can be said for my youngest child, my daughter, who's exploring what profession she would like to live her life in, and her commitment to athletics as well, which she's still participating in a variety of different sports, like softball and like hockey.
It's awesome. And Joe Terranova, ticker symbol Joe T, I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Wall and Main podcast. And I really want to thank you for being such a valuable resource to investors through your contribution to financial media. And I promise you, we'll keep tuning in.
Doug, it was a pleasure to have me, and I hope you'll invite me back because I had fun.
I'd certainly love to. Thanks so much for joining us. Joe Terranova, ladies and gentlemen.